Welcome, everyone, to the Weber Training Teleclass, Infection Control Practices in First Response Emergency Services, Science or Attitude. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar at the University of Ottawa, and all of the volunteers around the world who make teleclass education work, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for joining us on this teleclass today. Now, our faculty for this teleclass is no stranger to infection control, and I dare say no stranger to most of you. Margaret McKenzie has worked in infection prevention and control for more than 20 years, including 6 years in urban emergency response. She is presently in charge of infection control for the City of Edmonton Emergency Response Department, an organization of, I understand, more than 1,000 first responders. Marg gave a teleclass earlier this year on a related topic, and the reviews for that teleclass were excellent. She puts a lot of work into her lectures. She does them very well. You're going to love this presentation. To present Infection Control Practices in First Response Emergency Services from Edmonton, Alberta, it is a distinct honor for me to once again introduce my good friend, Margaret McKenzie. Marg.
Thanks, Paul. And hello to everybody. I know I have many friends listening in today, so it'll be great to hear you at the end of the session. The accent you hear as I present is Australian. I've been in Canada for 40 years, but I just cannot shake that accent. My travels back and forth, I guess, tend to renew it all the time. So let's get started. Infection control practices in first response emergency services. Is it science or is it attitude? In the last class, we talked about people, places, and the practice of pre-hospital care. And I left you with a question. Is infection control a science or is it an attitude? So let's go through and look at this. And towards the end of the session, hopefully, we'll have an answer. So infection prevention and control, you can see what I think. It's an attitude in action, right? 24/7. You pre-hospital people are familiar with that. Infection control is not just something that we do at work. We do this at home too. It's the way you teach your kids. It's the way you deal with snotty noses in your little toddlers. It's the way you prepare your food. The principles all remain the same. And the reason that we practice these infection control principles 24/7 is so as we maintain our good health and can carry on our job. So let's look at today's objectives. Sorry, I'm forgetting to tell you next slide. So we're up to the objective slide. We've got to identify the role of infection control in emergency response settings, to identify components of any infection control program, and to describe infection control processes essential to preparing a department to function in a crisis. Now, before I go too far, I must share some exciting news with you, and many of the people who are listening in today may have heard this already. In Winnipeg on May 9th at the National Chica Canada Conference, a group of interested people, people who are interested in pre-hospital care and in infection control in pre-hospital care, got together to see if we could develop a special interest group under the Chica Canada umbrella. The support was overwhelming, and so we are going to move ahead with that. There are some key drivers across the country. Greg Bruce from Barrie, Ontario, from the Simcoe County EMS, Jennifer Amiot from the Greater City of Sudbury, and Randy Gwynn from Toronto Fire. The four of us have committed, and we've got other people involved as well now to carry this forward. We have the support of the EMS Chiefs of Canada, and our three priorities for this year: to develop a best practice document for infection control in pre-hospital care. We're hoping out of that will fall an audit that various services could use to go through their department and say, do we do what we're supposed to do? And to develop, particularly across Canada, a communication system. So what does infection control do? Any of you who are on the call who are infection control practitioners get asked this question quite frequently. But in the emergency response setting, there are a variety of things that the infection control program would do. Say you were asked to take care of infection control for your service. Where would you start? What would you do? So you would take the principles of infection prevention and control, and you would look at peer-reviewed published literature, and you would use the information that you come up with to influence the practice of your first responders. So you'd need to check the literature first and find out exactly what's out there. There are two articles that I referred to in the last teleclass, and they're on actually one of the very last slides in this presentation. But the two articles I referred to were certainly one of them lists that regardless of the setting, the program goals for infection control are to protect the patient, protect the healthcare worker, and protect others in the healthcare environment, and to accomplish these two goals in a timely, efficient, and cost-effective manner. I did mention last time that pre-hospital care workers need to sort of tweak their paradigm a little to give equal emphasis to protecting the patient as they do in protecting themselves. And we talked at that time about the emphasis that is given in pre-hospital care to occupational health and safety directions, which tends to slant your infection control perception towards self-protection. We also and must not forget the patient in this particular setting. Next slide. What does this achieve? And this is so important. Pre-hospital care is much more than getting the patient to the hospital alive. Pre-hospital care should also mitigate any risks to the patients which may result in his or her demise 24 to 48 hours later. So what happens then if you have some good program goals and you gear towards the patient as well? You're providing a single standard of care across the healthcare continuum, and that goes then from curbside to grave. What are the principal functions of an infection control program? And this is also from the original article that I referred to. There are five components. This is to any infection control program. It doesn't matter where it is situated. Surveillance is the first one. You need policies and procedures. You need interventions to prevent infections. You need education and training, and you need the resources to be able to do that. With surveillance, the definitions need to be relevant to the setting. They need to be simple and of practical importance. They need access to relevant computerized databases. Now, I realize that this doesn't work in rural settings, but they need access to some relevant patient information. And they need to be able to be shared across the continuum of care. So, for example, with public health or maybe with the hospital that you report to. So definitions could be narrowed to reflect the pre-hospital setting. Are they practical? For example, you would want to look at your high volume, high risk to the patient, those sorts of issues. You'd need to look at your ability to handle large numbers within your system to be able to do the calculation. And you need to look at if it's of importance to others, like, for example, emergency departments or public health. Next slide, please. Developing policies and procedures. The key areas of policy development are things like airway maintenance, IV starts, wearing PPE, and then you get down into things like laundry, cleaning, and waste disposal or garbage. They need to be appropriate and feasible. They need to address all the elements of care as it's provided in the pre-hospital setting. They need to be current, and they need to be accessible to staff. They need specifically to be compliant with regulations, guidelines, accreditation, etc., and they must be evidence-based. They need to be consistent with the scientific knowledge or with expert consensus. Next slide. The interventions, all of these policies then lead to interventions. Your interventions would be preventing the transmission of infections, to improve performance by identifying trends and intervening to change practice, and to control outbreaks. Now, with quality indicators, for example, which would be your improving performance by identifying trends, you might want to look at exposures, and I recognize that this by many people would be titled an occupational health and safety issue, but it's often the responsibility of the infection control person in pre-hospital care. So how do so if you're going to look at them to improve performance or to change practice, what sort of questions do you ask when you're looking at your exposures? Do you identify where they're occurring? Do you identify how they occur? Are they connected to a specific practice? Or are they in a specific place? Do they occur on scene? Do they occur during transport? Or do they occur in the emergency department? These are all issues that you need to look at and use that information to influence your practice. So just reporting that you had 5 needle sticks and 3 eye splashes and 10 blood to the mouth in 1 year is not enough. You need to give more information. Let's go with the next slide, education and training. In-depth about any in-depth training about diseases, communicable or otherwise, is unnecessary from an infection control perspective. More important is how the routes of transmission work. So only rudimentary knowledge about infections specific to the practice setting is really necessary. And you just need that rudimentary knowledge so as you have a better understanding of the practices required to prevent transmission. For example, when an inner-city patient who is debilitated continually coughs in your face, do you know what action to take then? Or do you wait until you find out he has tuberculosis and then wish you had taken some precautions? So it's the coughing that's important, not particularly the tuberculosis per se. So the sort of practices that you might incorporate into your training at this time would be to use a blanket, ask the patient to put the blanket over his mouth, or to mask the patient, but to mask yourself first. Don't spend time trying to get a patient, an uncooperative patient, to wear a mask and put yourself at risk in the process. Next slide, please. Resources. Infection control must clearly be the responsibility of one person, and that person should have specific knowledge and training relevant to infection control and epidemiology. And it is published in the literature that this is far more effective. So one person should be assigned that responsibility, and most important in the pre-hospital setting is to have dedicated time to deliver the program. This has been proven, as I said, to be most effective. Next slide is resources. This is very important. One of the things that the infection control officer, or whatever you call the person who's carrying out your program, must have is the authority to carry out the components of the program and be totally supported by senior administration in their ability to do this. As the knowledgeable person in the organization related to infection control, now more than ever, that person must be seen as someone of authority and trust. You need to have your staff understanding, believing what this person can say. Now, next slide, please. Now, I talked about this in my last teleclass in considerably more detail. And we went into, for those of you who are not on the first teleclass, we talked about how the First Responder Health Canada guidelines occurred and came on board. In 1994, the First Responders met with Health Canada. So the first guidelines that came out were actually driven by First Responders in Canada themselves. And guidelines for post-exposure notification were developed and published. And this, as I said previously, created a paradigm of self-protection rather than focusing equally on the quality of patient care. So we need to look at that there are other published guidelines in Canada that can be utilized by pre-hospital care, and we'll talk about those in a little while. Okay, next slide. Let's look at these program components to answer some questions. How do we begin to identify the need within our own department? What sorts of things might we want to do? And this may be a little overwhelming for you, and I don't want you to feel that way. If you get one thing out of my talk today that you feel that you can actually pick up and go and look at your service, do an audit to see how it's functioning, that will be great. Don't feel that you have to establish this program right away. It takes a while to build in the components of the program, and you probably have a lot of them existing anyway. So let's look at the next slide, hospital type surveillance. The sort of surveillance, if we were going to look at the type of surveillance that they do in a hospital and transfer that over into pre-hospital care, we would probably do things like looking at the incidence of pneumonia occurring in patients intubated in the field. And for those infection control practitioners from acute care that are on the call, that would be pre-48 hours hospitalization, so you would in the hospitals be considering these pneumonias to be community acquired. Or we might want to look at the rate of IV site infections occurring in IVs started in the field if they're not changed in the emergency department. Or we might want to do something like focused community surveillance. That might be helpful. It's a patient quality of care thing. Not the focused community surveillance, but the other two. But few departments have the sophistication to do this type of surveillance. Now, in the focused community surveillance, Jen Amiot from Sudbury is doing a paper for her Centennial College course, and she's looking at, it's a part of influenza planning, looking at utilizing paramedics as community sentinels. And she's developing that into her her paper. So that would be a type of community surveillance that might be something that would be of value to public health. Next slide. Or there's other type of surveillance that you might want to approach, which sort of fits in with the influenza pandemic planning and so on. And this was certainly a question that came up during SARS, is to look in your own department and say, how well can I answer questions? Who of your ambulance staff were in the emergency department between 2300 hours on Friday and 1800 hours on Sunday? Now, this is something that they had to do in Toronto during the SARS outbreak 2 years ago. Can you pull that information? Does CAD have the ability to do it? And if it does, how many of your staff members know how to pull that? I asked this question in my department and had an answer back in about 10 minutes. But I think there's only two or three people who know how to pull that particular report. So you might want to look at that. How do you identify how many of those people were wearing N95 masks? If you work in a large urban ambulance service, you may have to go through quite a few people to figure that out. Now, in smaller services, how do you address things like, let's use an example from a call that I had a year or so ago about a tuberculosis patient in Emerge. One crew from this rural service had brought in a TB patient, and that crew was concerned about going back into their workforce again. And the second crew, there'd been a second crew that had brought in another patient who were in contact with the first crew. And they had a third crew who was transporting. Now, I got a call from the superintendent of that particular service. And the infection control people on the call today will know that I sort of had a little smile first and then said, how many cars do you have running in your service tonight? Well, he said, I have three cars and they're all tied up. So he was in a little bit of a bind. So we had to explain the whole process around contact with tuberculosis. So it's really important that you have some sort of a reference that somebody can go to look up this information, to be able to free up your crews. One of the things that is really critical in the pre-hospital environment is the ambulances need to be able to move. And if they're tied up in the emergency department or tied up because they need questions answered, this is taking them out of service and really creates difficulty for the service as a whole. So your policies and your education related to stuff like that is really important. Let's go to the next slide. You've got a scenario here and a suspected anthrax event. And following 9/11, a lot of us were faced with these particular events, and particularly down in the U.S., I know you had active ones. We had practice ones up here. Of course, we never knew if they were real or not, but my own department in 3 months post 9/11 experienced about 95 calls related to free powder in the community. So if you ask the question, how many of your firefighters were at the incident? What level of protection were they wearing? Were any of them exposed? And even what's the definition of exposure? Would you be able to answer that question? Well, for those of you who remember, I did present an abstract related to this at the Chica Canada conference in Newfoundland. And some of the things I found when I was reviewing the documentation related to these calls, we'd get a comment like two firefighters suited up and entered the building. Well, it doesn't tell you who. It doesn't tell you what level of protection they were wearing. It doesn't tell you whether they went into the hot zone, how long were they in there, and what were they doing while they were there. So education is required in this case, but how do you even find out that this is not being done unless you ask the question? So one of the things in infection control that you have to do is you have to make an absolute pain of yourself by asking questions and asking questions. And I can warn you, if you don't want to hear the answer, then don't ask the question in the first place. So next page, retaining and managing data. Do you have a mechanism for doing this? Can you create easily ongoing reports for management? And, I mean, smaller services can most probably manage with paper records, but larger services should use a computer software program. I have somewhere between 20 and 25 exposures a year in my service total, and I have mine on an Excel spreadsheet, and that works quite well. If you're collecting other data, you might be able to do it within your computerized system. One of the concerns I have in pre-hospital is getting an accurate denominator, and I've had quite a bit of problem with this. But after much searching, I'm using the per 100,000 hours worked or per 200,000 hours worked, and you need to ask the questions, though, when you're getting your number, if you're getting it from your human resources or whoever you're getting it from. You need to ask the question, who's included in that? And can you weed out places like administration? Because really the denominator you're wanting is your frontline workers. So you want to be able to weed out your educators and your deputy chief and your chief and all those people. Next slide. So when you've got all this information, what do you do with it? I mean, there's no point in you sticking it in a file and putting it in a drawer and not acting on it. It should be used to change practice. You should have a committee established to formally report infection control issues too. And in most cases, legislation requires you to have an occupational health and safety committee. And you can include your infection control in that committee because there is a lot of crossover of information. For example, if you find you have introduced new equipment and you're seeing an increase in exposures, where do you take that? If you've introduced new equipment, you've done the training attached to the new equipment, like, for example, needleless IV system, and you're still seeing exposures, you may need to increase the training or repeat the training. And that can be activated from a level of an OH&S committee, which usually has a large management component, and not have to go through a lot of channels. Or if you're getting lots of eye splashes, you have the ability, because you have representatives from your frontline service on the committee, you may have to look at the issue of safety glasses and how your safety glasses are being used. Are they being used? And maybe increase your training. So next slide, policies and procedures. Policies should be in place, certainly addressing the basics. Are they up to date? Are you aware of current national, provincial, and municipal legislation and how it affects you? So they should be written to be evidence-based and fitting the legislation. They should not be written stating what you do now. There should be a degree of research done, people of authority or guidelines of authority used, and written accordingly. So if you have practice that is different, it needs to be changed. Next slide, policy development. One of the things that became very obvious following SARS in Toronto was the need for working with hospitals and public health officials to work at policy development and to make sure that you develop guidelines that are meaningful and workable for all players. Are you using the same language? Or do you talk about universal precautions and the hospital and public health system talks about routine practices? Do you know the difference? Do your staff know the difference? Do they think it's something that routine practices is something that is way above universal precautions? So you need to think about those sorts of things. Pandemic planning, it's become very obvious that we need to be involved in regional planning. The pre-hospital people need to be sitting at the table. They need to be active participants to help the hospital folk understand the pre-hospital culture because it's different. Planning is also required within your own department as well, and you may be given the responsibility, as I have been, to make sure that a total pandemic program is developed. I'm not just responsible for the infection control component, I'm responsible for the whole thing. So it's really important that you look at those issues, and pandemic planning is a must right now. It is really, it might even be closer than the horizon, we don't know. Next slide. So in policy development, a system must have practiced communication. So that's internal communication, but specifically communication with your public health agencies and with your hospitals, with the people that you interact with. You must have a communication system that is reliable, that in an emergency you know you're going to be included. You must develop a trust with these people, and you must have respect for the other's area of function, or this is doomed to fail under pressure. So it is so important that those lines of trust be developed in the pre-pandemic period, in the pre-crisis time, and not try to establish them when you're in the middle of a huge crisis. So let's go on to guidelines. Which ones do you follow and why? So one of the most critical things to be aware of is for staff to have buy-in. For staff to have buy-in in the things that you're recommending. And to do that, all people should be doing the same. Now, in my service, and I don't think that other services across the country are all that different, we have firefighters and paramedics who are married to nurses and doctors and respiratory therapists and so on. So they go home and they start talking about what they're doing, what their policies say, and somebody else says, oh, well, my policy says this, and because it's a hospital, it must be better or whatever. You need to be consistent across the board. So is the language that is being spoken, the expectations are the same. Because one of the things we really need to work at in infection control is establishing and maintaining credibility with the people that we serve. This gives our workers a sense of security, and in a crisis, they need to have that sense of security. Which guidelines do you follow? The challenge for me, because I'm in a joint EMS fire department, and I'm governed essentially by particularly the NFPA guidelines, which are written for fire departments. There and there's also infection control guidelines that come out from the International Association of Firefighters as well, and you can switch to your next slide. While their principles are the same, they use different language, and this does provide confusion. So one of the things that you need to teach your staff is what sort of guidelines do they follow? Do they follow infection control according to CNN or to CBC, or do they follow the guidelines that are published on the Health Canada website? CDC often has guidelines for first responders that are actually labeled as such. But particularly in Canada, we are working very hard to change the language in our guidelines. They're very institutionally based right now, and we're trying to expand that so we talk about acute care rather than acute care institutions. And anybody who works in the pre-hospital field knows that you guys provide acute care. Then that acute care would include pre-hospital. And of any of the guidelines that I've been working on, I've tried to have that included. And then it gives you a feeling of inclusion rather than a feeling of exclusion. It also doesn't mean that you've got a lot of work to try and apply specific guidelines. So in Canada specifically, you're better to work with the Health Canada guidelines. Next slide. These are the two references that I referred to back at the beginning of my talk, and they were also included in the last one as well. The requirements for the infrastructure and essential activities of infection control and epidemiology in a hospital setting or in an out-of-hospital setting. There's also one that is written for an in-hospital setting as well. Also, we have professional standards of practice, and that publication is listed for you as well. There's also guidelines such as the intravenous guidelines, prevention of nosocomial pneumonia guidelines, and routine practices or standard precautions. All of those can be applied very well into the pre-hospital environment. Next slide. So So if you're a service that is large enough that you have students or volunteers that ride along with you, what do you do with students in a crisis? Have you discussed this with your educational facilities? Do you have a policy or do you have a written agreement? And do you have written into that agreement whether the students are going to work or whether they're going to be pulled back into their training program? Do you want to use students? Are you going to build students into your pandemic planning and say, yes, we will use students to keep our service on the road? What's your volunteer policy? Do you have a cadre of people that could help you by working in non-risk situations? I'm working towards retirement, and I'm thinking that that would be a rather nice task, actually, to be called in to assist in the time of a crisis, to know that I know the organization well enough that I could communicate information or help in some way, shape, or form, even if it was making a pot of tea and cutting sandwiches. But you know the system. Discuss, when you're talking about students, discuss and put this into a contract. Now, let's go to the next slide, and now we're getting into the interventions and guidelines and so on. Where can we get basic information? We've talked about major infection control program type references and so on, but where can you get the really basic information that you need? Stuff like, you know, how do you know what policies are on hand washing? How do you know what glove use is? How do you know about cleaning, etc.? So where do you get that? Let's go to the next slide. The two documents I've got listed here are two Health Canada documents, and my apologies to those people who are on from the U.S., but you have very similar sort of documents that come out of CDC. You've got the hand washing, cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization in healthcare, which is a very good basic document. And you have the routine practices document. These are common across the board. They're used in hospitals. They're used across long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and so on. So they're very good guidelines. These, you'll notice that the website is on there across the slides. They can be brought up from that slide. You can also go into the CHICA Canada website, www.chica.org. Click on the resources tab and you'll see the, I think they're PPHB guidelines that are listed under that tab. And if you pop in there, that's an easy way to find them. You'll come up with all sorts of guidelines. It's great fun. So what sort of interventions would you be looking at for employee health? Do you have an employee health program? Are your staff offered vaccinations where appropriate? Because often infection control in the pre-hospital setting takes responsibility for these things. Flu vaccine. Do you know that your firefighters or EMS people are covered for Hep B before they go out on the road? Have they had their tetanus shots? So those are some of the things that you might want to think about there. Next slide. What about intervention for prevention? Do you have an exposure management program? Do you follow public health guidance for restricting workers with communicable disease? And by those, in some of your settings, I'm sure you're very similar to mine. My paramedics are mostly quite young, and they have young children at home. So do you know if one of your workers gets pertussis or if he develops chickenpox? Do you know what you need to do with that worker? Do you have someone with expertise and the authority to identify these issues and take control, particularly in an outbreak situation? And we don't see this very often in pre-hospital, but if you get something like SARS, for example, where you very quickly end up, very much a big part of the healthcare system, then it becomes a huge issue. Is that person on call? Are they available 24/7? I've become fortunate in my dotage to be able to have somebody take call for me when I'm away. But I know when we were in Winnipeg, Greg was still on call for his Simcoe County. Jennifer, I think, was on call for her people. So, you know, we don't always get away. And certainly with my within my early days, I didn't get away either. I got away, but I was still on call. So this is a negotiated process. It's something that you need within your department to negotiate. Does someone keep the stats? Who looks after those? Where are they kept? Are they confidential? Where do you report this stuff? Do you take it somewhere where action can actually be taken to change practice? These are all important things to be looking at. So let's go to the next slide. I forgot to say at the beginning, but all the pictures, well, all the pictures, all two or three of them that are in this presentation are actually from the emergency health system in Halifax or in Nova Scotia. So thanks to them for the borrowing of the pictures. When you look at interventions, you're looking at engineering ones. How well do your frontline workers know their ambulance and know how it functions? Do they know why it's designed the way it's designed? Do they know how the air control works? What do they have to do to clear the air in their ambulance if they've transported a patient with tuberculosis, for example? This can become a big issue because in hospitals, usually the time involved is an hour. We don't have time to take our ambulances off the road for an hour. And if you check with your manufacturer, with our manufacturer, for example, it's having the ambulance static, windows closed, air intake on full, exhaust on full, 4 minutes. 4 minutes. Big difference from an hour. So you need to check with your manufacturer. What about the cupboard design? You can see the cupboards there are very smooth, so they're easy for cleaning, the cleaning surfaces and so on. How do you position your sharps containers? Are you seeing a lot of exposures when your people are trying to dispose of their sharps in the ambulance, and do you need to move them? And for those of you who are non-ambulance people, there is not a lot of wall space in an ambulance for you to make decisions to change. So you need to be sure when you put your equipment in there. Let's go to the next slide. So what do we do to prevent the spread of bugs in our environment? We have to know that bugs don't just jump around. They've got to have a mechanism to be moved around. So it's either somebody coughing or somebody's dirty hands or it might be poop or something like that. There's got to be some way, a mechanism of moving it around. What do we do to prevent transmission of bugs? One of the things that we're very familiar with in pre-hospital is glove use. But hand washing is ultra important, really important, and cleaning the environment is important too. So after the transport of each patient, even if it's little old granny who you feel was very clean, you don't know what you were touching while you were transporting her, you need to clean your environment before your next patient. You need to be very conscious about spreading bugs. One of the biggest bugbears in pre-hospital care is that patient care record back, the board that you carry your patient care records on, and your pen. I can just see all the pre-hospital people rolling their eyes. Yes, they know that that's one of the main things because you're handling that with your gloved hands. Are you always conscious of what you do with those gloved hands? Do you go into emergency, do you take a patient into an emergency department and do you pick up the phone on the desk? Do you put your PCR thing backboard down on the desk? Do you touch other things on the desk and so on and so forth still with your gloved hands? You need to be conscious of the impression that you are giving other people. One of the things that we need to look at, and let's flip to the next slide then, which are practices. And I've pretty well referred to that. When do you put your gloves on? When do you take them off? When do you clean your ambulance? When do you clean your equipment? And what do you touch with your gloved hands when you get to emerge? Does think about it. Think about it in the process of your work and see how you apply that. When do you put your gloves on? You don't need them on to drive the ambulance. That's very important. I tell my guys they're really lucky that the windows are so narrow in the ambulance that I can't see inside. You don't need your gloves on to drive. You can put them on when you get to the call. Next slide is cleaning and disinfection. How do you clean? What product do you use? Do you do your own laundry? And a lot of the more rural services do their own laundry. And you need to be very careful if you're doing that, particularly to make sure that your staff are protected and that you're following the right guidance. Now, how do you know that you're doing the right thing if you're doing your own laundry? Well, you go back to that cleaning and disinfection guideline that I gave you and check in there, and it will tell you. You all can also refer to the APIC curriculum as well, which is a fabulous reference for any agency. The new one does have good sections. Well, the old one does too, have good sections on laundry and all those sorts of things. And you can refer to the generalized section. It may not be in the pre-hospital section, but you can refer to the general section to know what you're doing. Do you understand the basic principles of disinfection and sterilization? Can you identify your non-critical, semi-critical, and critical items and make sure that they are disinfected or sterilized accordingly? All this is in that cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization document. It will allow you to go through and look at your equipment and say, yes, this is what I need to do with this, and this is what I need to do with that. One of the critical things when you're buying new equipment, and I don't think I said this before, but when you're looking at new equipment, always ask the question, how can this be cleaned? How can this be cleaned? Because often what happens is that the manufacturers really have not always taken that into consideration, particularly if you're having stuff designed for your use specifically. So it needs to be a question that's asked all along, a very general question that's asked. Next slide. Let's look at clinical practice. What safety precautions do you have to have in place for both the patient and the medic around intubation, for example, or suctioning, or your nebulization, or other aerosolization procedures? What PPE do you have available? Personal protective equipment. Do you have N95 masks on your ambulances? Do you have gowns available when you need them? That's really, really necessary to have on your ambulances. Next slide is education and training. I firmly believe that infection control is not a freestanding program. I firmly believe that it needs to be a thread that's woven through all education programs. And if any people should be taught about infection control and understand it, know how to apply it, it's educators. Infection control personnel should be involved in all planning for education, so you make sure that the components are built in. I have watched, to my horror, very experienced paramedics of mine demonstrating on television how to do an intubation without gloves, without a mask, and without their safety glasses, because they're doing the technical component of it, and they don't realize that part of that whole procedure is to take the safety precautions in the first place. It's coming, but we need to work on that. Next slide is challenges. So I've already referred a little bit to transport times or times where you're held up in the emergency department, but response times are important too. One of the challenges we have here is shift rotations. If I'm going to get to every fire station to educate every firefighter in my area on every platoon, I have to do 96 presentations. Now, that essentially takes approximately 3 months of probably 3/4 of my time. So you need to come up with alternate ways of doing your education. Type of activity that your people are doing and the experience they have too is also very important. However, we have such things as computers. It's really great to be able to put educational programs on computers, and particularly in Nova Scotia where the places are wide apart. The same thing would apply in British Columbia, where you could essentially put a program on a computer and it could be looked at by a variety of people. We can have teleconferences like this one. The teleconferences that are provided through Weber Training are excellent. Or we can have specific conferences or little workshops in our own areas. We need to be creative. Next slide. When we talk about resources, we need to do things like create an opportunity for your own staff to get infection control training. Coming up probably this fall, I would think, the availability of infection control courses, there's going to be a huge plethora of them out there, particularly in Canada, and I know they're available down in the States through the local APIC chapters as well. But create an opportunity for your own staff to get infection control training, be it one or two people in your organization. I've just got the Chica Canada website on there, but the APIC one is available as well. And there are other training courses available too. Of course, the alternative is to hire a consultant. You can do that as well. However, that person is not integrated into the system. They would be coming in purely to develop your program for you and train your people and then would move out. Let's go to the next slide. So, science or attitude? That was the first question we started with. Science or attitude? I firmly believe that infection control is based on science, incorporated into policy and protocols, communicated by education and training, and supported by practiced interventions. Practiced interventions. So without attitude in practice, infection control objectives will not be met. Thank you for your attention today. Paul, I'll hand it over. We've got a couple of minutes. I think we can have some questions.
Well, thank you, Marg. Actually, I don't think I can tuck questions into the time that we have left, but I will supply your email address to everyone, and certainly they can email me if they wish. My email address is on the handout and on the title slide. Marg, thank you very much for another great teleclass. And also, I wanted to say thanks for taking the lead in the coordination of infection control efforts in the emergency first response field. I understand you've been pushing for this for some time through Chica Canada and Health Canada.
I have, but I now have some very, very enthusiastic first responders, and I named them before, Greg and Jen and Randy, who push me, which is great. We're going to accomplish great things.
We'll look forward to that. Marg, thank you again for preparing and delivering an outstanding teleclass. Thanks again to everyone who's joined us. A special thanks to Janet Allen of Hotel Dew Hospital, who has lent me her office and her phone to host this teleclass. Thanks to Janet. It's amazing how much chocolate she has hidden away in this office. Folks, I hope you'll all join us again. And if you didn't register for Marg's last teleclass, but you'd still like the handout material, just send an email to me and I'll look after that for you. So until we meet again, stay safe. Goodbye.
Thanks, Paul.